92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
Let's face it, in our busy lives, we don't eat enough fruits and vegetables. In fact, according to the CDC, only 1 in 10 Americans are eating the recommended daily amount of fruits and vegetables each day, missing out on essential vitamins, minerals, fibers, and antioxidants. And that's where Balance in Nature comes in. Balance in Nature sources only the best produce, free from pesticides, heavy metals, and harmful bacteria. And Balance in Nature is the best fruit and vegetable product on the market. They use only fresh whole fruits and vegetables inside each capsule. They don't use any GMOs, fillers, binding agents, or preservatives of any kind. You're getting real food, real science, real nutrition. I would never endorse a product that I don't use myself, and since using Balance in Nature, I feel more alert, I have more energy, my focus is sharper, and I feel great. Live life to the fullest and choose Balance in Nature. And guess what? PAS Report listeners can get 35% off the first preferred order. Start getting the recommended daily amount of fruits and vegetables you need by using code PAS at balanceofnature.com.
Welcome to the PAS Report Weekly Roundup Podcast. The PAS Report provides an honest analysis on the critical issues that matter to you without the biased media filters. Here's your host, Professor Nicholas Giordano.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the PAS Report Podcast. Here's your host, Nick Giordano. I hope every one of you enjoyed the July 4th holiday. It's so important that we remember why we celebrate our independence. And despite what the left says, our founders were giants amongst men. I got a lot of feedback for Monday's July 4th special episode, and many were shocked that they never heard the names I mentioned. There are so many that never get spoken about, so many that played large and small roles in our founding that never get discussed. One of my listeners remarked that if only people would learn about America and our founding by reading, listening, and researching, that they would see for themselves what a great country we are. And he was 100% right. You would think that we would have an education system that would actually do that, that would be teaching this stuff. Instead, the schools would rather focus on far-left activism and indoctrinate them with a false history leading to a deep-seated hatred for the country that we live in, the greatest country in the entire world. This is why only 38% of Americans are extremely proud to be American, and why only 2 out of 3 young adults have no idea who we declared our independence from. It seems that this country is on a decline, and it's why I'm bringing in Adam Ellwanger. Adam is a professor at the University of Houston. You may have seen his work in Real Clear Politics, The American Conservative, Human Events, and more. He recently wrote an article published in The American Conservative entitled Top Gun and American Decline, and he explains the national reality of our military, our adversaries, and our leadership here in the United States. We live in an America where competition and perfection is now discouraged as mediocrity is rewarded. And how 40 years of catastrophic policy decisions have led to this American decline. Before I bring on Adam, make sure you go to the PAS Report website, PASReport.com, sign up for the newsletter. Also, make sure to hit follow or subscribe button on the podcast platform that you're using. This way, you'll never miss an episode of the PAS Report. With that out of the way, I want to bring in Professor Adam Ellwanger to the PAS Report. Professor, it's so good to have you here. How are you today?
Doing very well, Nicholas. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm glad you could come on because I wanted to talk to you about your piece, especially given that July 4th just passed. And it was about the American decline, basically looking at the new Top Gun movie. And in it, you bring up a really interesting point that this movie is not the America of today, that it's the America that would have been had we not had catastrophic policy decisions from the elites over the last 40 years. Can you explain that to the audience?
Yeah, well, I was 8 years old the summer the original Top Gun was released. And I think at that time, the United States was in a position of undisputed global power. And I think part of what the movie Top Gun was a celebration of that fact. And I think watching that movie at that time, it felt like the America we lived in at the time. It felt real. And I was reluctant to go see the new one at first. I didn't even like the first movie that much, you know, but I thought, we'll give it a try. I took the kids to see it. It was fantastic. I loved the new movie. But also, I was struck the entire time I watched it by how the America it presents really doesn't feel like the America that we live in today, even though it's a it's supposed to take place, you know, in the current year. I still have the images of the Afghanistan withdrawal in my head.
I think many of us do.
Just yesterday on Twitter, a video was circulating that the U.S. Navy had put out to educate the people in the Navy about how to use people's preferred pronouns. And we get one of these signs about every 2 weeks or so from the military that their concern really isn't ensuring American security, advancing American interests. It's more about advancing the political football in the culture war at home. In Top Gun Maverick, I didn't see any sign of that. What I saw was a powerful military that was proud of sort of American military dominance, global dominance, and a preeminent state in the world. I just don't feel like that's the nation that we live in.
And I agree with that. I mean, when you look at it, the fact that our military is more concerned with pronouns than they are of, let's say, communist China and their expansion in the Pacific is really something that is extraordinary, because you would never think, if you remember the 1980s like I do in the 1990s, when you think of the American military, you think of strength, you think of competition. And one of the things that you pointed out in the article is the idea of excellence and competition is no longer fostered. I don't think it, not just within the military, but throughout our entire society.
Yeah, I think that there's essentially what I've called elsewhere a war on excellence. I think that this partly stems from sort of a radical democratic spirit in the United States. And what I mean by that is that we've sort of fetishized the idea of equality to such an extent that we've gotten to the point where we have to crush aptitude or work to keep down excellence so that we don't have disparities in outcomes. We see this, for example, in some of the high schools that are getting rid of advanced mathematics in their curricula. We see it in university admissions. I'll give an example that I saw at my own university. They're very concerned with accessibility. And so what they want professors to do is to anticipate any potential way that your course could negatively impact someone who has any kind of disability. And so one example that they gave was colorblindness. And they said, look, there's colorblind people who are out there. So any of your course materials should be adapted so that they are usable for people who are colorblind. And we said, well, what if we don't have anybody who's colorblind in our classes? They said, that doesn't matter. Right. We want all of your materials to be adapted for any conceivable disability, whether or not there is anyone with these conditions in your classrooms. Now, I mean, it should be obvious that this is actually impossible to do. Right. But ultimately, once you take into account every possible disability that could occur, you have to make some compromises, which generally lowers the level for everyone else, the level, the demands, the push towards excellence. So I think we see this all over our society, particularly in the military. I mean, one example is lowering the physical fitness standards to enlist. I should preface this. I got a lot of military guys dunking on me after the article because they're like, you're not in the military. You're just an English professor, blah, blah, blah. You couldn't make the cut. Can you fly a fighter jet? And the answer to all those questions is no, I can't. But I am an observer of military culture. And what I'm saying is that the signs that the non-enlisted Americans get from what the military is up to on a day-to-day basis is that they're more interested in this war on excellence than any other war on the face of the planet.
And that's what we see. You have you brought up Afghanistan earlier. I mean, Afghanistan, we spent 20 years in Afghanistan, trillions of dollars, lost 2,600 American soldiers, 20,000, over 20,000 were wounded. And the end result is the Taliban is better armed and equipped today than it was when we first invaded. And not a single military leader has been held accountable, not just a military leader, those within the intelligence community, those at the State Department, all these people for 20 years were telling us that we were making progress, that the Afghan military can hold their own, that the Afghan government is stable and it's not going to collapse. And it took a week, less than a week, actually, yeah. And it all fell apart. And it seems like America has been conditioned to lose. I mean, when you look at the last 60 years of American military might, I mean, realistically, the only real campaign that I could think of that was an overwhelming success was 1991 Desert Storm, where we had the simple objectives that were measurable. It was to repel Saddam's forces from Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. We did that within 2 months, and then that was it. We pulled back, instituted no-fly zones. Outside of that, I mean, can we point to any realistic military successes? I mean, I guess taking out Slobodan Milosevic with NATO allies, that was a success as well. But outside of those two examples, we failed politically in all these major campaigns we've been on ever since. How do we begin to correct that situation?
I don't know if you can, because you mentioned that nobody's been held accountable for the debacle that was Afghanistan, and I don't think anyone will be. And I think in order to change this culture, that's what needs to happen. At a certain point, and you're right, I think that we've had sort of a long line of failures militarily in the United States. At a certain point, you have to ask, is the real desired outcome even to win at all? Or is there another objective here? Because it seems like, we spend more on military endeavors than any other country on the planet.
That's
and
for
if
sure.
The best that can buy is a draw with the Afghans, a nation that really doesn't even have an air force, then do we really need to spend all that at all? Or are those expenditures not designed to fund a military that can win, but they're designed, those expenditures are aimed at achieving other objectives under a cover of military security? I don't know the answer to that, but I'm starting to suspect that really the goal isn't to win these things at all. The goal is extrinsic to that. I mean, as long as that's the case, I don't think it can be reformed personally.
You know, that's actually a great question that you bring up. And I don't think I've looked at it from that point of view. I mean, to a certain degree, I have. Is it more about the contractors and the military industrial complex and supporting that financially? And that's what drives us to these long engagements where we have no winner, because it is baffling. I mean, listen, as far as our military goes, when it comes to actual battles, we win every single battle on the battlefield. But we lose the campaigns, and that's where it becomes into the political realm and the political element, and then no one's held accountable, so it turns into even worse. But something else you pointed out in the article was that if we look at Top Gun in 1986, well, we'll remember that it was our top-of-the-line, technologically advanced fighter jets versus these old, outdated MiGs, where if we look at Top Gun that was just released, it's no longer those outdated MiGs we'd be going against. It's the top technological feat of China that we'd be going against. And it really shows how we've fallen backwards for some strange, bizarre reason.
Well, that was a horrifying point in the film. And it's not a big spoiler, but once the opponents in sort of the heat of battle in the new movie scramble their air force and get up in the air, you see this fifth generation fighter jet kind of float up in the face of our F-18. And what was horrifying about that to me is it looks quite lethal. It's an enemy of the good guys. And that is our technology. It's not theirs. It's ours. You know, we gave it to them. We designed this stuff. This is an imitation that they have of our technology. And Trump talked a bit fairly commonly about sort of the industrial espionage and theft of intellectual property that has happened over the last 40 years. And I mean, the strides that a nation like China has made in technological terms over the last 40 years are astounding. And it couldn't have happened if the United States hadn't been compliant with that. And in fact, in a lot of ways, we weren't just compliant. We helped it happen. We sort of brought them up to speed technologically in the interest of offshoring our manufacturing needs and engineering needs. So we kind of had to teach them these things in order to for us to get cheap TVs, you know, and America's got priorities.
You look at everything that exists today in our materialistic world and what we've given up in the process, and we are complicit in the rise of China. We are complicit in their growth and their technological growth. And again, it comes down to no standard. China has not been held accountable for any type of corporate espionage that has existed over the last several decades, and they're allowed to get away with it. There's no punishments. I want to get to the point of you have all these so-called experts, all these policy geniuses over the last, you know, 40, 50, 60 years that all said that we should open up to China, that we should engage in a strong relationship. Now, I understand it. Back in the 60s and 70s, it actually made sense. We wanted to create that wedge between the Soviets and China. We saw that we could do it, and we took advantage of it. But the theory was that if we open up to China, ultimately China will become more like us. Instead, the exact opposite has happened, and we've become more like China. On every single issue we think of, like the policy experts have been totally wrong on most of the major issues that exist, and yet they're still the ones that go out there, spew their nonsense and say they know what the hell they're talking about.
Yeah, I think that part of this is sort of the vanity of liberalism. I mean, there's still an assumption that liberalism is so self-evidently superior to any other way to live or any other form of regime that we simply don't even need to make the argument for it. I think that there's an assumption that sort of capitalist affluence of the sort that we have in America is synonymous with sort of democratic sentiment and a desire for liberal governance. What we found out, well, we should have known this already, but what we found out is capitalism and liberalism are not the same thing. And we essentially taught China to be capitalist. We assumed that this would necessarily make them a liberal democracy. Turns out you can, in fact, adapt capitalism to an authoritarian communist vision of society. This is a hard lesson. I don't know if the people running our country have learned this yet. I don't know what it would take for them to learn it.
Well, I look at it from the perspective that it's about, like you said, mediocrity. Like that's what's being pushed in and out every single day. Let's cut the standards. Let's drop the standards. I mean, even as college professors, we've seen a rapid decline in writing ability amongst the student body. Like it's not a secret. The proficiency levels of students is far lower today than it was 20 years ago. And it's, you can't fail everyone. And so you begin to drop the standards. And I could guarantee it's not just at an institution like mine or yours. You look at the Ivy League institutions like Harvard. I could guarantee you that the papers of today don't compare to the papers of 40 years ago. So I think what's happened is you have all these people, these mediocre people that got into all these positions of power, and that's why they push mediocrity.
Yeah, and you mentioned sort of the writing thing, and you've kind of hit a nerve for me because I'm an English professor. Your listeners should know.
Yeah, you have a much harder job than I do, I'll tell you that.
It's really horrifying. Your listeners should be aware of this. It was underreported. The National Council of Teachers of English, the major professional organization for English teachers, both K through 12 and college, right, put out a position statement earlier this year that said that the teachers of English nationwide should reduce the emphasis on reading and writing of essays because presumably
my kids still read.
Right. Well, you know, what the argument is, oh, it's all visual culture now. It's all making videos, you know, this and that. Do we have this focus on reading abilities? Why do we have this focus on writing? And it's just astounding that this is coming from English teachers. It's not coming from business departments or, you know, anywhere else. It's coming from English teachers. And it's really just astounding to me.
Yeah, but it doesn't shock me because, you know, it's funny because the left has controlled academia for the last 50, 60, 70 years. And they constantly talk about the academic achievement gap. Yet it was the left that kept schools shut down in all the inner cities, the urban areas, for over a year and a half, where a lot of schools in the wealthy neighborhoods, they all reopened. But it was the students that are the lowest achieving that need the most help that they shut down. So they'll preach that they care about these people, but yet they actually hurt them with their policies. And the writing, it's the same thing. I don't care what profession you go into. You need to know how to put together a cohesive sentence that people could understand. And when you sit there and you tell students, well, writing's not that important. Well, that's why a lot of them, when they graduate, get their four-year diploma. The businesses don't care about these diplomas anymore. It's why resumes automatically get rejected, because there's grammatical errors throughout the resume. There's spelling errors that are so obvious, so glaring, that these students don't get any calls back. And instead, they spent 4 years out of college, but they're working as a cashier at Target. I mean, that, and then they wonder about the student debt. What's the point of education if you're not really educating students?
Yeah, I think that, well, that's the point of the universities is no longer to educate. And that's a much longer conversation. But on the writing aspect in particular, I'll tell you one thing that no other English teacher in America will tell you. Writing can't be taught. It can't be taught. And just like you can't teach someone to ride a bike. If you say, how do you teach someone to ride a bike? Well, you put them on the bike. And you say, move your feet, I'll hold the seat while you go. And then you let go while they're not looking. The only way to learn to ride a bike is to do it. You can't read a manual on it. Writing is the same thing, right? And here's the problem, is that if it's true that the only way to learn to write is to read a whole bunch and write a whole bunch, and that's the fact of the matter. Well, the decline of standards then is going to ensure that we have people who can't read or write, because we're not forcing them to do the amount of activity that will be necessary to master that task. And that's the only way to do it.
Go ahead. I have to ask you, as an English professor, as someone that does writing for a living, essentially, when you read government documents that come out, when you read even newspapers in today's day and age, like how many errors are you finding?
Well, tons. Many of those are not hard and fast grammatical errors. Like, say, someone who's writing for a newspaper understands all the grammatical rules of the language. What they don't understand is stylistic conventions. And so, for example, and this is probably going to bore your listeners now, but like a good writer doesn't end a sentence with a preposition. And there's no hard and fast rule against that. It's just good writing to avoid doing that. But you'll see that a lot. Yeah, the government documents are a whole different story. They're totally inscrutable. And that's by design, usually. These bills that we see come through Congress, they're 2,500 pages. I'm a dude who likes to read. I haven't read a book longer than 300 pages probably in 15 years. Nobody's even reading this stuff. And of course, you know, Nancy Pelosi had the famous line for Obamacare. Well, we have to pass it to find out what's in it. Well, no, you don't if you read the bill, but that would require that it's not 3,000 pages.
Well, if I had my way, I would have a constitutional amendment that says any bill that's being proposed can't be over 20 pages. I mean, let's be honest here. If I read tons of bills, and the scary part is I actually have read through some of those, you know, 1,500, 2,000 page bills, and it'll take me months to get actually through them, if not years, because there's so much legal jargon in there and then cross-referencing. If you look at every single bill, it could literally be put in 20 pages in normal English language that people understand, everyday common language, and instead they make it overly complicated. But as you said, it is by design. It's so people do not read it. And again, I think it speaks to the idea of mediocrity. If you look at our politicians today, and I don't care, Republican politicians, Democrat politicians, with the exception of a few of them, most of them would never be able to survive in the real world. They wouldn't be able to hack it in a real job. They would be utter and complete failures because they're incompetent. But I think that unfortunately has now seeped out into the broader society, where, getting back to your article, we see that lack of perfection. So it used to be that no matter what you did, if you go back 40, 50 years ago, you wanted to have excellence in your craft. So if you were a carpenter, you wanted the job you were doing to be perfect. Now it's just rushed, in and out, in and out. unfortunately, we're seeing that all too often now within our society, and it's literally in every single bureaucracy. It's really damaged our society. As far as America goes, do you think that we could stop the bleeding, essentially, like, you know, stop putting plugs in the bleeding and at least balance it out before we're too far gone? Or do you think that, unfortunately, because of the way our society is and because of the types of students that we're producing, that it's going to be very hard to undo what the far left has done in this country?
You know, that's a great question, and I hope it's possible to undo it. I know
we don't want to be all doom and gloom here.
Right. I hope that it is. But that said, I'll say that there's great incentives. Life's easier if you're lazy and will tolerate sort of general state of crappiness. If you'll accept a crappy job, or you're willing to settle for a crappy job or poor quality, life's easier that way. Right. It's harder to say, no, this isn't good enough. No, I can do this better. I do think that I'm not sure how old you are, but roughly probably my age.
Yeah, what about same
and
age?
I think that it kind of falls to guys who are our age to do this, in part because we still have a memory of what it was like in the before times when there was still sort of a culture of excellence and a rewarding of aptitude. And I think, frankly, like, you know, I'm raising my kids and I try to point this out to them, open their eyes to it, because they don't remember that old world, to say, look, this isn't the way it always was. Look at these people are settling for less. Why? And I think that that's kind of the only hope, is we have to transmit the memory and the culture of the before times to the present. Because the thing about, you know, like, excellence is you only know it when you see it. And if it's not encouraged, you never see it. And so you don't know it.
And I think that's a great point. And I want to piggyback off that before times, because I look at it where we could actually pinpoint exactly what was the before time versus what was the after time. The before time was pre-9/11, where Americans actually appreciated liberty and freedom, where it didn't matter if you were a Democrat, a Republican, a Libertarian, or an Independent. We appreciated our founding fathers and what they were trying to create. We understood that they weren't perfect people, but we understood that the vision, the ideology that they were trying to create, was something that was noble, that's something that was great. And then in a post 9/11 world, we got the national security state apparatus being built out, where it was no longer about appreciating individual liberties and freedom. Now it was about obey and comply, bow down to the state apparatus, because the state apparatus has your best interest in mind. And I noticed this a couple of years ago when I was teaching my students, because I've been teaching since 2006. So whenever 9/11 would come around, I'd give an entire lecture about the lead up to 9/11, the growth of Al-Qaeda, how it formed and everything. And my students would really be into the lesson. They would really take it in. They'd all sit there wide-eyed, wanting to hear more. And then over the last few years, I started to notice that when 9/11 came around and I talked about it, I wasn't getting that same look. I wasn't getting the same participation, the same interest, the same inquisitiveness that I used to get. And I was thinking to myself, wow, it happened. These are all post 9/11 students that I'm teaching. They don't remember an America where we were free. They've been born after that. And so it hit me then that they view 9/11 as we would view, let's say, Pearl Harbor. It was a horrible event that happened in our history, but move on. And, you know, we're dealing with the stuff today. Did you notice a difference when you were teaching, as you moved further and further away from 9/11, the student engagement towards 9/11 dropped dramatically?
Absolutely. And it's, you know, I started teaching in 2005. And at that time, you know, you had kids who experienced the actual event, right? Then you had kids a few years later who were 5, 6 years old when it happened, had very vague memories of this. Now you have kids who weren't born, and frankly, they just don't give a damn about it. And I'll tell you a disturbing experience I had just this summer. I went to Baltimore for a conference, and I was walking around the...
At least you survived it.
Yes.
That's right? Good.
There was a lot of American carnage, but around the harbor there, they have some nice stuff. And I was walking around, beautiful day, sun setting. I see a public sculpture, an iron sculpture. It's kind of twisted up, almost like almost abstract and surreal in some way. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. That looks neat. And I saw some kids are sitting on top of it, beating it with drumsticks. And so I walk over and I think, like, well, what is this thing? And I finally get around to the side where the plaque is. It's a twisted beam from the World Trade Center. And then I kind of felt bad for thinking, oh, that's kind of beautiful. But then I saw the signs all over it. Please don't get on it. Please don't do this. And, you know, there's 5, 6, 7 teenage kids on top of it, just beating it with drumsticks. And like, I was angry a little bit. Like, I was kind of like, that's irreverent. Like, get off of it. I felt some feeling of the sacred there that clearly was absent in them. And I don't think that they were trying to be edgy, right? Like, they weren't like, hey, let's disrespect this. It just never even occurred to them that that would be a thing to respect. And that, to me, was kind of a hard visualization of just how far away we had come from that event.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's sad to see the changes throughout our society, and hopefully we can return it. Hopefully we can restore it and bring it back. Adam, I enjoyed the conversation. Love to have you back on. There's so much to talk about that we could be here all day. So yeah. I'm going to have links up to the article at the PAS report. I suggest everyone check it out. Read the article. It's a fantastic piece. And all the best, Adam.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
I want to thank Adam for joining me, and everyone should check out his work, especially his article that we discuss. I have the links up at the PAS report in the show notes, so check it out. If you find the show informative, please give the PAS Report podcast a 5-star rating, take 30 seconds to write a review, and share this episode with others. I want to thank you for joining me. I'll be back on Monday with another great episode of the PAS Report podcast.
Thank you for listening to the PAS Report Weekly Roundup Podcast.
Have a good one.
Bye.
Be sure to rate, share, and subscribe to the podcast so you'll never miss an episode. Also, visit PASReport.com and follow us on Twitter @PASReport.